revisiting a few of our favorite guest artists from past years, an internationally recognized modernist sculptor, a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship recipient, and one of our favorite holiday guest storytellers. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, broadcast the first and second Wednesday of each month at 1:30 p.m. Ears on Art is dedicated to the enhancement, exploration, and education about the visual arts. The program is co-hosted and co-produced here at KCBX in San Luis Obispo, California, by myself and Krissa Hewitt. Krissa and I like to take the January programs to revisit past interviews that stuck in our memories. There are two subjects that we like to ask our guests. First, when did the artistic spark first ignite your interest in personal expression? And second, how is process and problem-solving integrated into your creative expression? The answers are varied, but seem, at their base, to have a common theme. Our first guest was particularly erudite in his response to these inquiries. Krissa traveled to Oakland, California, to the studios of sculptor Bruce Beasley, to speak with this fascinating artist. Bruce Beasley was discovered in 1960 by Dorothy Miller, the curator of painting and sculpture at New York's Museum of Modern Art. Miller included Beasley in MoMA's 1961 seminal exhibition, The Art of Assemblage, which featured such luminaries as Willem de Kooning, Jasper Johns, Louise Nevelson, and Robert Rauschenberg. The following year, MoMA acquired one of Beasley's sculptures, making him, at age 22, the youngest artist to be included in the museum's permanent collection. Beasley followed this auspicious beginning by becoming one of his generation's most productive and innovative sculptors. A self-described unrepentant modernist, Beasley continues in the tradition of modernist abstract sculptors such as David Smith, Anthony Caro, and Eduardo Chillida. And now, Krissa and Bruce.
Good afternoon, Bruce.
Good afternoon, Krissa.
What got you involved, do you think, not just in being a sculptor, but in being an artist?
Well, I guess it formally happened in college, undergraduate at Dartmouth College. But I always made things as a kid. I was the kid that as a little boy took all the mechanical toys apart and then sometimes put them together and some back together and sometimes didn't. In high school, I built pretty serious race cars. I've always made things. But I also read books and wrote poetry and pursued the side of the mind also. When I went to college, I was kind of being geared toward rocket engineering, figuring that that was the professional extrapolation of building hot rods was the rocket program. And I quickly realized that a lot of my pleasure in building hot rods had been aesthetic, not just making them go fast. I saw that engineers spent their lives with slide rules and little cubby holes and working with paper. And I wanted to make things with my hands and use my brain at the same time.
Was the art available then at the university?
But they had a beginning drawing class. And I took that and enjoyed the drawings, but the final exam for the class was 50 independent drawings. I don't know what possessed me, but I asked the professor if I could do 10 models instead. And I did that, and it was an epiphany for me, because I'm not saying that they were good pieces, but the discovery that I could make something in 3D, in the world, with my hands and struggling with my own thoughts, that spoke a human emotional language in shape and form was just exhilarating. And based on that, something went click in a way that nothing had before, and I said I was going to be a sculptor.
Can you talk more about what you find in the forms, in the materials that are able to give voice to things that are going on in you?
I think that for me, abstract sculpture was like discovering a language that I didn't know I knew. I mean, after all, we live in a world of shape. We're moving through shapes all the time. I think that our whole relationship with the world is one of shape. So therefore, making a conscious language of shape is talking to people about something that they really do know, but they don't know they know it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in a way, abstract sculpture is more real than abstract painting is. The arrangements of shapes that individually carry no emotional sense, the arrangement of those is like arranging musical notes, and they speak to us profoundly and basically through our own experience in the world. Sculpture is in the world we live in. Painting is not in the same experiential space or perceptual space. Painting is more kind of like a window into some imaginary space. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but they're profoundly different. Sculpture, you might say, is more like a person, and a painting is more like a thought. In one way, I've set myself the challenge to see if I can take a vocabulary that on the surface of it is inherently non-organic, Euclidean shapes, mm-hmm. simple Euclidean shapes. And can I, with that vocabulary, make a language that tells stories about living things? Because the sculptures are not, they're not about geometry. They're about animals, people, and living things. Not specifically, but they certainly relate to living things. Because one of the things that I very much want to do is to communicate that sense of impending motion that living things have just before or after they have moved. A diver or a swimmer just ready to leave the blocks or the board. And there's a tremendous sense of energy in that. And I have consciously wanted to evoke that without resembling it. So although the superficial language is geometry, the story is not geometry. I want to get to the heart of movement, flight, solitude, all of these, to me, deep and profound things. And so if I can get to those feelings without context, to me, it's really a thrill, and it gets more, it's more basic, more profound. The way it is here, what I'll call the original creation, takes place not on the shop floor. The work I'm doing now starts on a three-dimensional computer. The computer doesn't make any decisions, but it allows me to have really like a three-dimensional drawing pad. Mm-hmm. When I'm working with that original discovery process, that's in the computer room, and I'm alone at that point. So I start just arranging shapes, and at first nothing's happening. In other words, it's like playing notes on the keyboard, and God, it's all just awful. And then some little thing happens, some little clink that's, oh, that's a little interesting. And then I'll add something to it or try to go in that direction. But it's as though I'm discovering the sculpture, or it's as though I'm bringing it to life. And at first, it's like it's dead. Nothing's there. And sometimes it's fast, and sometimes it's slow or days, and nothing happens, and I think I've lost it. But eventually, something happens. And really, it's like it comes to life a little bit. And then my job is to find it and complete it. It's more like I'm helping it and discovering it than I am creating it. And then what happens is it will be there, it will have come to life, but there's too much. It's as though it's a little confused. Then I start removing things and to see how much I can remove before I kill it. Because start taking shapes out, and okay, no, it's still alive now. I take out another shape, okay, it's still alive now. When I take out the last shape, and then it's dead, then I put that last shape back in, because I want it to be just as minimum as it can be and still be alive.
That's resonating with me in a workshop I was just in, where we were asked to create some type of artist statement. It was just one of these 2-minute exercises, and I found myself speaking to the idea of exploration, and that the process was such a part of that, that when the process was done, it was time to start exploring again.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, I think exploration actually is a wonderful word to describe the creative process. I mean, I think that it is more, for me, exploration is much closer to it than expression, for instance. Or like you're mining for you know, you're trying to find those diamonds or something. But it's much more an exploration than it is an expression to me.
those times that are perhaps initially not as wonderful feeling when things don't feel like they're going well? How do you work through those? I assume you have a couple now and then.
Oh, yes. And by the way, to all the young artists out there, I want to say that I think one of the mistakes that teachers make in schools, they don't talk enough about that. Because it's not a question of whether you will go through dry spots. It's only a question of how often it will happen. It happens to all of us. And, of course, it throws us because the first reaction is, oh, God, I've lost it. I'm never going to make any more art again. I'm dried up. The muse is not there anymore. The only way that you get through those periods is you work through them. Good work comes out of work because the ideas come from the work itself. I think that people not in the arts don't realize how much of a dialogue it is between us and the work. If you stop and believe that the muse is going to flutter down and sit on your shoulder and blow in your ear, it isn't going to happen. And so when
they don't seem to work overnight either, when I keep thinking I can come back to the studio and go, where were you, folks?
And the other thing is the drugs don't help and alcohol doesn't help. You have to work through it and just keep making pieces. I think the creative impulse is common. So whether it's music or dance or poetry or painting or sculpture or whatever, what then differs is which way it pulls us. But I think that what we all have in common and why we understand each other basically is that the impulse is the same.
Question that I often indicate that I most abhor is it art when looking at something?
I decided a long time ago that to incorporate a qualitative judgment or a qualitative part with the word art is a fundamental mistake. Because then all it means is saying this art means I like it. And there is lots of bad art made, but it's art. And so I think it's a complete mistake to get into the qualitative with the art. I think that art is a complex process that human beings do. It's difficult to precisely define, but has to do with wanting to talk about human feelings through music or dance or painting or sculpture or what. And much of that does not connect. Much of it is mediocre, but it's art because it's all trying to do that. And so anyone who's trying to do that is an artist. But it is a complete mistake to say that's not art and that is art, if it comes out of an expressive intent. So the most beautiful rock is never art. The most beautiful sunset is never art. Art is a human activity. And it has relationship to nature. But the most beautiful nature may be more beautiful than any art can be, but it is not art. Art is an intentional human activity. But not all of it is wonderful.
that, I think, is the big difference of being able to say, because it was created and we're therefore calling it art, does not have to mean that it succeeds.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. That's right. Actually, art is a intent. That's very good. That'll help me in the future with this. Art is not a result. Art is an intent.
We go back to our word of exploration.
Yeah, that's right.
We had been sitting in Bruce Beasley's living room, and his collection of art had been impressing me for almost an hour now. And thus, our conversation turned to this topic.
My wife and I have been involved with prehistoric art. I went to the prehistoric caves 45 years ago. So thrilling to realize how important art has clearly been to mankind from the very beginning of the human career. At 35,000 before present, that is 28,000 years before agriculture, 30,000 years before the first brick was ever fired, before we could control where we lived, before we had a controlled food supply, human beings were making beautiful, sophisticated visual art. And I think that tells us something very important about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think it also says that art is something that is profoundly within us. In other words, it's not a result of culture.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. You have just heard a segment of an interview with the modernist sculptor Bruce Beasley. We now join co-host Chrissa Hewitt and her guest Norman Kennedy as they perform the ancient Gaelic tradition of felting hand-woven wool cloth. 12 women, one straw bale barn built by the three little pigs, three traditional Scottish ballads, two sisters, and one Scotsman, all for the purpose of walking the blanket. In a break from our normal format, we present a program that truly focuses on the audio aspect of the visual arts. Chrissa Hewitt now takes us to Atascadero, to the Straw Bale Barn Weaving Studio.
I was to arrive right after lunch, an hour Norman had determined to be a time of good energy for the work of walking the blanket. I enter to the sound of happy voices. These workshop participants had been together much of the previous 3 weeks, learning precious skills about weaving, spinning, and dyeing from one of the greats in this field, Norman Kennedy. Scottish-born, and for many years a resident of Vermont, Norman presents valuable centuries-old knowledge not readily found elsewhere. In September of 2003, he was a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellowship. The barn is large, the first floor workspace open and light. 2 6-foot folding work tables are set end to end. The blanket, about to be walked, is one designed and woven by artist Roberta Foster, an active member of the Central Coast Weavers Guild. The wool cloth measures 10 yards in length and approximately a yard wide. Eventually, it will be cut in thirds and sewn into a queen-size blanket. For now, the ends have been sewn together, forming a continuous loop. The width has been bundled into about an 8-inch diameter of cloth, loosely tied at regular intervals along its length. It has been washed and is still wet, though much of the excess water has been squeezed out. As the blanket is brought to the table, the ice-cold vodka bottle is cracked open, and shots are distributed in unceremonious plastic or paper cups. The women take seats around the table, with Norman sitting at one end. The material is passed down until all have part of the oval in front of them. Imagine yourself at the table, reaching out with both hands, gather the wool that is in front of you, pick it up, rotate your hands to the thumb side up position, and pound the cloth downward. Pass what is in your hands to your left, thump it down, and release. Pick up what has just been passed to you, and repeat. The rhythm, as you will hear, is a heavy beat, light beat, heavy beat pattern. Why is this done? It is a felting process that I will let Norman describe later. Let your ears take in the sounds. Let your mind envision the scene. Let your nose take in the comfortable odor of clean, wet wool. Now, through song, this internationally known folk singer keeps the rhythm.
So, as I say, this is a form of belting the cloth. Many ways of doing it, different ethnic groups have different ways of doing it. This is one of the ways they did it in the Scottish Highlands. And the songs, some of these songs, the Gaelic songs, were made specifically for this. Some of them from the 1600s, 1700s, quite common. But I'm not going to do long stuff here because we don't need it. This is only for blanketing. This doesn't need a lot of felting. The old blanketings would need a lot of felting because the rooms, the houses were so drafty. They didn't have slickers, you know, so they had to get their woolen cloth really tight, bounded. God help them. That's all they had. So, and you're doing it, Jaishal, you know, sun-wise, it would be really unlucky to do it against the sun. It would be putting a curse on it. Okay.
The process stops while Norman checks the condition and width of the cloth. This process shrinks it some. He positions his hand to configure a measuring unit he obviously knows well. He marks off the material and determines that the work is progressing nicely.
Cooper, he come here last night with trembling, he was weary. A trooper, he come here last night when the moon was shining clearly. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye, yeah. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye. Oh, God, are your ribbons real? In the morning, or I'll leave you.
Kay Thorne, one of the sisters who owns the barn and who has studied for many years with Norman, responds to the meaning of this event.
If you had to do it by yourself, about the only way you could do it would be in a bathtub or something with your feet, and it's awfully hard and it's boring. But if you do this regularly and you have friends who come, then it's fun. You have a social activity and everybody shares.
Should let an empty hat chamber. The ashes fade and breed and cheese and wine that was like amber. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye. Oh, God, are your ribbons ripped in the morning or I'll leave ye. Nice chorus, I must say. We'll do another one, and then we'll measure it and see who's coming in. The rest to my sister's bed and I bore Benori, oh Benori. There come a night to be that war by the bonnie mill dams of Benori. He courted the eldest with brooch and knife. Benori, oh Benori, but he loved the youngest and been his life, Ben the bonny meldams of Benori. And that should do it. And there's nobody in the Western world now doing work and singing at the same time, singing songs specifically for that work, you see.
As you now hear, there is nothing casual about the handling of Roberta's blanket.
So there you go. I'm going to do a blessing. You turn it three times sunwise, and then put a blessing on it so that it's good luck for the person using it and sleeping under it.
This last segment was about the ancient Gaelic tradition of felting new hand-woven wool cloth called walking the blanket. Our guide was National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship recipient Norman Kennedy, who incorporated traditional Scottish folk songs into the process. Every December, Ears on Art turns to our friends and listeners to be guest storytellers. For 13 years, we have selected a theme to help guide our guests. This story is from 2011, when the theme was Unexpected Transitions. Here's guest storyteller Kate Froman.
My name is Kate Froman, and I've lived here in San Luis Obispo for a long time. I enjoy making things with my hands, wall quilts, baby hats knitted with all sorts of fibers, and I love especially working with silk. It had been a different kind of autumn the year I was 9. My father had been out of work for weeks because of a prolonged bout with pneumonia, and he was drinking a lot. My grandma arrived one afternoon with some leftover pot roast, and I heard Mom tell her that she hadn't known what she was going to feed us that night. That was the first time I realized that there was such a thing as no dinner. My four sisters and my brother and I had been delighted with the boxes of used clothing that began appearing on the front porch, and we spent lots of good times trying things on and sorting out who got what. There seldom were any shoes in these boxes, and I had layers of newspaper between my feet and the holes in the soles of my shoes. Fortunately, we lived only 2 blocks from school, and there hadn't been a lot of snow. Few days before Thanksgiving, another box appeared, and my mom cried when she lifted out a turkey, a bag of potatoes, and cans of vegetables, a pumpkin, and a big box of oatmeal. A few days later, a Christmas tree was propped against the porch railing. Just as she had done the year before, Mom took each of us shopping to buy a small gift for our siblings. A Woolworth store had just opened, and I remembered buying a comb for one of my sisters for 10 cents. Our past Christmases were usually modest, with the presents consisting of hand-knit mittens, home-sewn pajamas, a tangerine or an orange in the toe of the stocking, and a little bit of chocolate, and one real present. My sisters and I usually received gifts like a doll, or a stuffed animal, or a tea set. I was looking forward to a new doll, or a giant box of 200 crayons that I was definitely not going to share. I knew my mom stayed up half the night wrapping gifts and stuffing our own socks. No giant Christmas stockings for us. The socks were laid at the foot of our beds for discovery first thing in the morning. When I opened the small flat package on Christmas morning, I stared at the little burgundy velvet cape trimmed with white fur. My mom said quietly, "It's for Laura." Laura was my doll, which I had hoped would be replaced by a newer, bigger, and better one. I looked at my mom and saw the hope in her eyes, the hope that I would be okay with this gift, the best she could do. It took me a moment to understand that this was my real present. I went and retrieved Laura from under my bed and dressed her in her new finery. That night I realized that my mom had sat and sewed and trimmed that cape late at night when all six of us had made all the obligatory trips to the bathroom after the second or third drink of water. And I realized that mom had given me all that she could give, a scrap of burgundy velvet and a few inches of white fur. That was the year I realized that times were tough for my family, and I was afraid for a while. I also learned, though, that there were limits to what one might have. There were very few limits to what my mother would do to keep us safe and fed and loved.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would once again like to thank today's guests, modernist sculptor Bruce Beasley, blanket walker Norman Kennedy, and storyteller Kate Froman, all of whom generously gave of their time and expertise. To hear prior programs for Ears on Art, visit kcbx.org and select Archives. Programs from the previous 2 years may be found there. Also at kcbx.org, you can find information on the new schedule of programs. You have been listening to Ears on Art at its new time of 1:30 p.m. on the first and second Wednesday of each month. Ears on Art is produced in the studios of KCBX Public Radio, serving Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and southern Monterey counties on California's Central Coast. Offices for KCBX are located at 4100 Vachel Lane, just off of South Higuera, near Los Osos Valley Road. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, thank you for listening and for your continued support.